Hello again, and welcome back to another one of our Bird Bites. And I'm again back talking with Wilbur Liebman, the former chair of the National Labour Relations Board in the US. Wilbur, many academics and commentators, indeed journalists, have said that the American labour relations system, the system that was put together, you know, as part of the Roosevelt New Deal, is now broken beyond repair. Can't be fixed, that it no longer serves the interests of the American working class. Would that be your view?
I think it's pretty close to my view. In fact, I've written about this. While I was a member of the National Labor Relations Board, and I think about 2007, I wrote an article called Decline and Disenchantment, talking about the initial promise with this law, how it worked for a while. For several decades, it brought a middle-class way of life to millions of people who voted in elections conducted by the National Labor Relations Board to have union representation and had the benefits of collectively bargained agreements. But as we talked about in our earlier segment, starting about in the mid-1970s and increasingly since then, this has broken down. It just hasn't worked. Since the 1980s, a variety of labor law scholars have talked about this broken labor law. They've called it America's unfulfilled promise, an elegant tombstone for a dying institution, an anachronism irrelevant for most workers and firms. And I think while most people would agree that the law is outdated, beyond that, there's no consensus about how it should be fixed or if it should be fixed. The defenders of the labor law say that the law, although it needs serious strengthening, is critical to a democracy and to a fair economy. But its detractors, and there are detractors, say that government should instead limit the power of trade unions as an impediment to the operation of markets. Some detractors contest any role of government at all in the free market. And certainly in the last, say, 30, 40 years, deregulatory policy trends have accelerated and previously discredited notions of a laissez-faire economy and notions of freedom of contract have revived. And I think what we are seeing in the last few years are the results of those deregulatory trends, or what is popularly called neoliberalism. We talked about this a little in the first segment. In addition to that, we have a long history in this country, goes back to the 19th century, of institutionalized anti-unionism. This is much more so than in any other capitalist country. And so there has been a strong, organized, and well-financed resistance to unionization, to collective bargaining. And so typically when a new regulatory regime comes into place, typically people will comply with it. But that has not been the case with labor law. So increasingly, particularly during this period of the late 70s to the present, employers have used a variety of means to suppress unionization, to resist it. And the law itself has such weak remedies that most employers would say, when they would do the cost-benefit analysis, they would conclude that we'll spend money to defeat unions. We'll even spend maybe thousands of dollars to hire anti-union consultants to kill a union organizing campaign. And even if down the road, the National Labor Relations Board or a court says we broke the law and we have to put some people we fired back to work and pay a little bit of back pay, that the remedies are so weak that it's worth it to us to try to either kill a union organizing campaign or delay it as long as possible.
What in your view, Wilma, explains what I might describe as the ideological hostility of American employers to unions, which, as you say, appears somewhat as an outlier when we look at, say, other legacy market economies in Western Europe and elsewhere? Why have, in your view, you know, do you think American employers have this anti-union mentality?
Well, I think it's attributable to a lot of things. For some, it is really a question of what they see as economic rationality, that if we're unionized, it's going to cost us more. For some, it's we don't want to have to deal with anyone. We run these, it's our business. We run it autonomously. We don't want anything that's going to restrict our autonomy. Kind of in keeping with a libertarian strand of American political philosophy. And for some, it is deeply ideological. So, and I think I've often said that the fault lines over labor law and policy, the supporters of the law, the detractors from the law, is very much reflective of the broader fault lines within American political culture. It goes back, I guess, to the combination of the diversity in this country and what formed this country initially. It turns to some extent on slavery and the reaction of the country to the freedom of the slaves and what happened to our economy after that, what the different views of what was considered freedom. Wage labor, for example, came to be viewed as just another form of bondage. Some people saw freedom as just the ability to sell your labor if you wanted to, as opposed to being a slave. But many in the developing labor movement said that's not enough. You know, there should be greater ownership of the means of production by workers. So I think early on, after the Civil War and the next few decades, there were contrasting views about what came to be known as industrial democracy. The employers had their views, there were radical views, there were trade union views, there were a wide sense of views. And then ultimately the vision for industrial democracy in the 1930s came to be collective bargaining, and all the other views kind of fizzled. Now I think with the current crises that we are facing, and not just the pandemic, but even before that, we are looking more broadly at what might be ways to bring some, to deal with our glaring inequality, to bring some measure of workplace fairness and democracy.
So the traditional, the New Deal model was based on the notion of collective bargaining, and indeed the notion of collective bargaining is based on strong unions dealing with employers and negotiating contracts. That model is clearly broken. And I suggest that what we're now seeing in the US is an attempt to find new ways of labor finding a voice. So we see ad hoc groups, not that ad hoc anymore, but we see ad hoc groups such as the Fight for 15 emerging. I think Black Lives Matter fits into that rubric of these sort of ad hoc looking for justice groups. And of course, we also see, and I know this is another subject that you're interested in, we also see the whole idea of social media as a new form of labor expression, whether it's from Google Walkout or whatever else. So could I suggest to you that the future of the labor movement is not the past, that we're not going to go back in America to collective bargaining, you know, in the mold of the New Deal model, but we're going to see new forms of labor voice and labor leverage emerging, so that, for instance, social media leverages a company's concern about its reputation rather than about the fear of a strike or a walkout. I know this is a subject you've looked at, so what's your thoughts on all of that?
I have a lot of thoughts, and a lot of it is unclear as to what the future is going to be, but I think one of the things that that is of concern about your observation that, or your view that collective bargaining is a thing of the past, is that the collective bargaining model, when it worked, approximated some equality of bargaining power between workers acting collectively and employers. And individuals attempting to bargain with employers is just not the same thing. And so what remains to be seen is whether these alternative forms of what you call voice, whether some of these ad hoc groups, whether the social media protests actually result in any kind of transformation or long-term benefit to workers' welfare, their rights, their livelihoods. And so far, it's not clear that any of these kind of loose organizational structures, even though they may be very good in creating a lot of disruption and changing the conversation, the Fight for 15 has clearly brought attention to and changed the conversation about the stagnant minimum wage. Just like earlier, the Occupy Wall Street changed the conversation and brought attention to glaring inequality. And the Fight for 15, although it has not ended up in unionization of the fast food workers or low wage workers, it has certainly resulted in increases in the minimum wage all over the country. But whether any of these more ad hoc groups, as you call it, or social movements result in real structural or systemic change is still something that remains to be seen, because there's nothing yet that addresses the disparity of bargaining power in a way equivalent to collective bargaining.
Yeah, but if my assertion that collective bargaining may be a model of the Fordist huge manufacturing plant industrial age is a thing of the past, I mean, I'd suggest to you that what we're now looking at is the nascent, you know, emergence of what I would call political bargaining, whereby groups like the Fight for 15 and others don't necessarily negotiate with employers, but they pressurize politicians, whether at the city level, the state level, or the whatever other level, you know, to legislate for minimum terms and conditions, and maybe beyond minimum terms and conditions, so that the focus of attention doesn't become collective bargaining, but becomes what I would call political bargaining.
Yeah, I think that certainly is one model that's gaining attention. Some call it wage boards, for example. So in New York City or in New York State, the governor convened a wage board for the fast food industry, and they came out, it was tripartite. They came out with recommendations that the minimum wage for fast food workers should go up to $15 an hour. And this wage board concept is something that's gaining some traction. There are proposals for labor law reform that talk about sectoral bargaining. Sectoral bargaining, of course, occurs in parts of Europe. I'd say it was the result of workers or unions having a lot of power, not the situation as we see in the US now, where workers have little power and hope that sectoral bargaining would be legislated to give the workers power. So it's not clear that's going to happen. But I think you're correct that absent the collective bargaining model, and in the United States, of course, only about 6.7% of the private sector is unionized. There's a larger segment of the public sector that's unionized. But absent a return and strengthening in the collective bargaining model itself, we're going to have to rely on government to improve terms and conditions. And I've always found it rather ironic that businesses in the U.S. don't want to see legislation to impose minimum labor standards, particularly if it's done at the state level and they're subject to conflicting and contrasting requirements around the country. But they don't want to see minimum labor standards legislated. So you would think that they would be happy to have it more voluntary, but they don't want the collective bargaining system either. So that goes back to your question, why has the U.S. business community been so hostile? And I think it's that in this country, they don't want their autonomy clipped in any way, and they don't want the government imposing any. They just want, it's a free market economy. This free market economy ideology or dogma has really taken hold in this country. I think, you know, yesterday the the House of Representatives held a rather historic hearing with the CEOs of the four tech giants. And I think, you know, it's clear that the tech world thinks of itself as great engines of growth and innovation, but they don't want any regulation of any sort. They don't want labor legislation. They don't want tax legislation. They want to be just left alone. And I think the views of this increasingly consolidated tech industry, to some extent, are reflective of the market ideology that has been dominant over the last 40 years, only it puts this ideology really in high relief, because it's really four market giants that control everything.
But you know, let me put this to you, Wilma, when you talk about that. Over the last several months, we have seen, not only in Europe, but in the United States, company after company lay off workers, furlough workers, put them on short-time working, whatever way you want to call it. You know, one of the few companies that has been hiring workers over the last 4 to 5 months has been Amazon. Yeah. Now, what's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with that, as long as they're paid well and have fair working conditions and the right to engage in collective bargaining if they so choose. Amazon has been pretty hostile to that idea.
Well,
they can work safely during the pandemic.
Yeah, but put that to one side for a moment. And let me put this question to you. Look, safe working conditions and so on, these are issues that, if they're found to be wrong, can be fixed. Right? But isn't it better that somebody has a job than they don't have a job? You know, Amazon has hired. It's hired people. It's been profitable, and I'm not quarreling about any of that, but it's hired people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, given them jobs, delivered services to people when they needed it. You know, if there are mistakes in the Amazon model, they can be fixed. But what would you prefer? You know, that you had a job in Amazon, or or you didn't have a job in Boeing, but you had a collective bargaining agreement in Boeing, but you don't have a job.
Well, obviously, jobs are important. I'm not going to deny that, as long as they're decent jobs and they're well paid and people are treated well. But, you know, you say safety can be fixed. You know, one of the things that's been so disturbing has been the unsafe working conditions in meatpacking plants and nursing homes. And these problems in meatpacking, the safety issues, have been around for forever, and they haven't been fixed. And one of the reasons they haven't been fixed is that meatpacking increasingly became non-union. It once was a highly unionized industry. So to some extent, good working conditions, including safety, are a function of workers having a voice and even a bargaining representative or bargaining power.
I've heard it suggested that one of the things that undermines any attempt at unionization in the United States is the concept of employment at will, that an employer can basically fire you for any reason he or she so chooses, other than discriminatory reasons. Now, in a way, the US is unique in the legacy market economies and not having some sort of legislation around unfair dismissal. And I've seen some recent writings of American academics and commentators, particularly on the Democratic side, if I can put it that way, saying that this is something that should be addressed by a Biden presidency. What would you say to that?
I know this is something you feel strongly about. I know you've told me that if you could change one thing about American labor and employment law, it would be the at-will doctrine. I think you're correct. I think it would probably go a long way in terms of making work more fair for millions of workers. I don't think, however, it addresses at least two other key problems about our system that distinguish our system from, let's say, Europe. It doesn't do anything to address the weak social safety net, so that, you know, healthcare, retirement benefits, family medical leave, sick leave, et cetera, have all been dependent on the employment relationship in the United States. We are now seeing the cost of that kind of heavy reliance as people have lost jobs and have lost healthcare and have no medical leave, have no family leave, have no paid childcare. So changing the at-will doctrine doesn't do anything about our weak social safety net. And it doesn't do anything about what I mentioned before, the disparity in power between workers individually as opposed to workers acting collectively and having collective power.
Okay, so look, the last thing I want to chat to you about is this. Now, it's no secret that you're a Democrat, you know, and I don't think it's any great secret that you would want to see a President Biden in January of next year rather than a President Trump. But, and let's assume that all works out well and that we don't have any difficulties, which would be difficult for the whole of the world and not just America, if there were to be difficulties about a transition of power. But if there was a President Biden in office from January of next year, you know, when he stood on the steps and gave his inaugural speech, what would you like to hear him saying about labor law and employment law and the social security net you talked about? Give me your priorities that you would like him to take on board.
Well, good question. I think as an opening principle, he has to be ready to address and to try to heal the racial divisions, the cultural conflict, the political polarization that Trump has encouraged and intensified. He didn't create these divisions, but he certainly encouraged them and intensified them. I think all these divisions and conflicts are going to be very difficult to heal. And of course, my hope is that a President Biden will come in with a strong Democratic majority in the Senate and the House of Representatives so that he can also get some things accomplished. But I think the immediate challenge is going to be, how do we heal all these divisions? This has been a very, very painful, traumatic time, I think, for most Americans. So how does he address that? I think what he has to do is say, our social compact is broken. We have to fix it. We have to address how we put democracy back in our workplace and in our society at large. We need to have notions that are befitting a large, very complex political economy, a workplace which is very diverse. So we have to have a labor and employment law that works for a wide variety of different kind of businesses and workplaces. So I would say that the collective bargaining, I'm not ready to consign collective bargaining to the dust heap as you are, but I think we have to have models of workplace democracy that are broader than collective bargaining, that allow for different models. You know, some people are looking at the co-determination system or works councils, but something that gives people a voice and some power short of our system. And, you know, in our system, it's all workplace related, a single establishment or less than an establishment. And if 50% plus one don't vote for a union, then there's no representation. There's no collective voice. We need to broaden that so there is a variety of different forms of employee involvement, participation, voice, and bargaining power. And we definitely have to address the social safety net and the systemic and structural racism. I mean, for years, the economists will tell you that not only do we have inequality, tremendous wealth and income inequality, but we also have racial and gender inequality. So women and Blacks and Hispanics have a much wider wage and income and wealth gap than do white males. So it's a tall order for President Biden.
So maybe take out the old Dunlop Commission report, blow off the dust and re-examine the options for workplace voice and democracy.
Perhaps.
Perhaps. So listen, one last question. If the phone rang on the 2nd of January next year and a President Biden said, Wilma, would you be available to be my Secretary of State for Labour? Would you say yes or no?
Oh, Tom, I told you not to ask that question.
Well, you know I was going to ask it.
That's not going to happen. But as I told you earlier, Avril Harriman famously once said, never turn down a job you haven't been offered.
Yeah, well, let me say this, Wilma. If I was President Biden, I'd be making that call. So,
I'll tell you, Tom, I'll be very happy if you give me a call to return to Sitges one day and I can actually get on a plane and come to Spain. I'll be happy with that at this stage of life.
To tell you the truth, Wilma, I'd be delighted to be able to drive to Spain at the moment, never mind to take a flight to Spain. So listen, can I thank you for taking the time to talk to us? It's been most informative and insightful. And like as always, because anytime you've come to Sitges and been involved in one of our meetings or one of our programs, you know, your knowledge and insight into the US labor system has been so helpful. And
thank you, and thank you for the great dialogue. I'm sure you'd find many Americans who would give you a different point of view, however.
Oh, I'm sure you find many, many Europeans who would ask you different questions as well, but that's another day. So, Wilma, thanks very much. And thank you all for watching this Baird Bite. And, you know, this is our last one until we come back in September. And we're already planning some exciting Baird Bites for September onwards. So next time, this is Tom Hayes for Baird. See you next time.